Sure, he and his brethren are attempting to resuscitate it, but it's only one witch he has to work with, and it's a horrible situation she's in from the sound of it. Lives like a prisoner, she does, under their watch all the time, for they want her kept safe, else their work comes to naught. So very limited her life sounds. And the worst of it is the work itself. They instruct her on all the magic she may do, and 'tis only ever sending they want her for, which, as you've heard myself and my sister Breeda tell you, is exhausting and often frustrating, for there are so many particulars to be kept in mind, and the risk of Lumma, and you haven't the satisfaction of accomplishment, for by its very nature the results are not where you are. And even worse than that, 'tis a strange mechanical chamber she must spend her time in, the only place magic will function in their age. Tristan described it somewhat to me, and for all the pride in his voice, 'tis his creation. It sounds a right horror, so it does. So this poor witch is living under nasty circumstances, and more than that, she is nearly 200 years old. Magically preserved she is, so for all those years she survived, aging slowly, in a world with no magic, making friends and then watching them die of old age, while she waited patiently for the time to come for her to spend her day in a horrible little room doing unpleasant tricks on demand for a secret government. For that's the other part of his confession. Tristan and his lot aren't bringing magic back for the good of the world, or for magic's own sake, but because his government, what rules over the nation full of Irish who speak English, wants to use magic to spy upon and check the power of other kingdoms. Now, I've nothing against that. Sure, we're doing it ourselves, right now, and who doesn't? But it's nothing to the glory of magic. It's nothing to the artistry or craft. And worst of all, it's a horrible life they're giving this witch by the sound of it. I asked Tristan was she happy, and he said not especially. But he thinks that is due to she's Hungarian and they're not a merry race. And he has a point. Still, very sad I was to think of the state of affairs. Not at all as I'd imagined it when first he told me their aim was to bring back magic. But all of that is nothing compared to the horror to come. For Tristan's crew is an evil one, and never was there more evidence of that than the story of Lester Holgate. 'Tis a fell tale I'm about to impart to you, so I hope you are nursing some potent spirits to get you through it. Tristan was giving it a rest with Sir Edward. As soon as he arrived and told me and Rose all, for didn't I summon Rose to be a witness to his story too, he went from the Tearsheet Brewery with Rose. She was friendlier to him now, given as how he had spoken with us more openly, as he'd promised. In fact, she had offered to introduce him to other witches around, of whom she knows more than I, having family here. She is about to be married off to a gentleman, pleasant enough, but very dull, and it appealed to her sense of adventure to be assisting a handsome fella from the future, especially in the name of magic. The plan was that Rose would take him to meet her mother and aunts, as they're a whole family of witches, like Breeda and myself, with the grandmother out on the Fullenham estate by the Shepherd's Bush Green. So it's an overnight trip he had left on. And didn't I feel like a mother, seeing her son off to the wars? No, in fact, I didn't. A bit of a relief it was. So there I was on my lonesome upstairs at the tavern, taking the rare chance to air out the closet and the bedding, when suddenly there was a shimmer in the corner of the room, and there's another naked fella, with his hair cut in a peculiar way. He's about as tall as Tristan, but thinner, less imposing, good teeth, though, and he falls to the floor moaning, like they do. He most certainly does not seem familiar, telling me he's only on this one strand. Something strange is afoot here. One of those things that Tristan would call an anomaly. As soon as he could speak, he looks around the closet like it's Newgate Prison, and he's no idea how he got condemned to be there. "Have a seat," I say, and pat the mattress beside me, but Mr. Anomaly looks nauseated and stays where he is, covering his shaft but feigning not to. I give him a moment to collect himself, chuck an extra set of drawers and shirt at him, and wait for him to dress himself. He's not so much to look at, a wee bit soft around the waist like a bride is. As it happens, we've collected some of Ned Elaine's fancier costumes from Dick Burbage, should Tristan ever have occasion to chat up the court witches, or courtly associates of Sir Edward in nicer places. But Tristan was wearing his regular costume that day, so the fancier one was at hand, and I gave it to this new fella. Such a mess he made of putting it on, you'd think he was from the Indies. "Can't you lace a doublet?" I asked in amazement, and he doesn't even seem to hear me as he's trying to figure out what the devil to do with the codpiece. I barely keep myself from crying with the laughter, but finally we get him dressed. And then, for the first time, a quarter hour after my hands have been all over him to help him dress, he looks at me directly. He's not a bad-looking fellow, but it's city air he breathes a lot, I'm guessing, not like our Tristan. For his complexion is sallow, like a hatter's, although fashionably pale, and he squints a bit, like a tailor. He carries himself well enough, but unsteady he seems to be, as if a permanent amazement he is trying to hide. And his hair, Your Grace, 'tis a thing best not spoken of, but I'll speak of it anyway, as there is much worse to come, and as it enters into the narrative in a small way. The whole time we were struggling with the doublet, his colourless, limp hair kept straggling down over his brow, and nervous he was in tucking it away. And didn't I then remember a thing that Tristan had told me concerning his unlovable colleague, Les Holgate? He employs a surfeit of product. I'd no idea what he meant by it, but he'd said it as if revealing it was of something important concerning the man. So I had pressed Tristan for an explanation, and didn't he say, "That means his hair is gelled until it's hard and shiny as a beetle's back. It is a kind of pomade that some in my time use." Tristan, understanding that none of this product or pomade would be sent with him, had grown out his own hair and had it trimmed in accord with our fashions, so that conspicuous he wouldn't be. But this fellow hadn't done so much. And since his product has stayed behind in the chamber whence he'd been sent, wasn't his hair now all over the bloody place, and a court fool he seemed to be? "Les Holgate," I say.
"The same,"
he says, and he holds his outstretched hand toward me. I look at it, wondering if I am expected to kiss it, which I've no intention of doing. So I wait. After a moment, he drops it onto his lap.
"You must be Grainne."
He pronounces it wrong, and he knows it. "Why must I? And what business is it of yours if I am?"
"I'm a colleague of Tristan Lyons, you know, from the future."
"I know.
I'm here to help him with his deed."
He pats his hands on the bombast of his hosen, then crosses his arms, then puts his arms akimbo, as if arms are something he's just acquired and hasn't yet worked out what they're good for. "A colleague, are you now?" I ask. "Let's have you prove it. Tell me a bit about his deed, and why he would be needing your help, and what kind of help you're intending to give him."
"We have no time for that," he says, frowning.
To be honest, he looks almost confused that I would be questioning him. Quite peremptory, he seems to me.
"I have no time for foolishness," I retort.
"These are dangerous times, and I dare not take a stranger at his word. I'm needing evidence you're Tristan's fellow. Tell true." Mr. Anomaly harumphed a bit at that. Then he pushed his hair back, rubbed his hands together, and said briskly,
"We are trying to disincent Sir Edward Greylock from investing in the Boston Council. Tristan has tried speaking to him on multiple occasions, but the results we seek have yet to eventuate."
"And those results are?" I asked. Irked, he looked, as if it were an imposition to speak of it.
"The removal of a certain building 40 years from now in massive shoe hits."
I continued to question him in this vein, with his impatience and irritation compounding, until, despite his queer language and displeasing attitude,
I had satisfied myself that he was indeed on Tristan's crew and served the same masters with the same ends in mind. "So what exactly are you here to do?" I concluded my questioning. "We've figured out a better way to change Sir Edward's mind about where to put his money," he says. "Since Tristan was already here in 1601, we couldn't give him the new instructions, so we've called an audible and made an unplanned insertion. I've got some specific plans to enact, and I need your help, just like you've been giving it to Tristan." "As long as you understand what I have not been giving to Tristan," I say, for his talk of insertions was putting me on my guard. He was not near so comely as Tristan, and I didn't want him to be making any insertions on my person. But he gave me a strange look, as if he hadn't the faintest idea what I was referring to. "Certes," I said, letting it go. "I am in league with Tristan, so by association I am in league with you. Be stating your intentions, O man from the future." "I'm going to put Sir Edward between a rock and a hard place. Make him an offer he can't refuse. Turn up the heat." "All right," I said cautiously. "Yeah, here's the plan. The constable of this parish, St. Mildred's, I know what parish we're in," I told him. "He's poor, easily corrupted, he tells me. I reckon he must know this from his history books, and don't I know it from my own life? Introduce me to that constable, and then, separately, introduce me to one Simon Beresford, the father of Sir Edward's fiancée." "Why's that, then?" I asked. "Well, Sir Edward uses this whorehouse, right?" "Once or twice," I said. "There's a girl here he likes, Tristan told me." "That would be Morag. Bit of a gymnast, she is." "We have to get the constable to inspect the whorehouse while Sir Edward is here with her, and Sir Edward's future father-in-law is with him on a ride-along." "On a what?" I asked. I did not like his attitude, or his strange accent, or queer way with words and phrases. I did not like the notion that Tearsheet would be inspected. But, in truth, all the bawdy houses are targets occasionally, and isn't Tearsheet overdue for it, on account of my magic fending it off so long? Often's the time a parish constable will squeeze a whoremonger for money. Constables are given power, but no money at all, and so usually held by somebody with a high enough opinion of themselves who happens to be short on coin. "Well enough," I said, "but Simon Beresford, the father-in-law-to-be?" "Yeah, I don't know where to track him down. He's a lord or something, knows the queen. We have to get him to go with the constable on the inspection." "And why would he do such a thing?" "So that he can report to Queen Elizabeth which of her courtiers was caught in the whorehouse." He seemed chuffed with himself for this idiot scheme. His arms, when he wasn't using them to push his hair out of his eyes, hung more casually at his sides now, as if he'd grown accustomed to them. He was finding his sea legs, as your grace's men might say. "Hardly seems like something a gentleman would care to do," I pointed out.
"Good way to win points,"
himself said confidently, in that tone that says he has made up his mind about it, and therefore any new information or suggestion has the weight of mist. "Also, if we drop a hint that his future son-in-law might be one of those in the brothel, then Simon Beresford will have a pressing need to see for himself who comes out of the brothel door during the raid." I shrugged. "There are hidden exits on every floor for the customers to leave unnoticed," I said. "Constables have sought them out for years and never found them. It's a matter of great pride at Tearsheet. Morag knows those exits same as any of us. She'll take Sir Edward out of there to safety."
"No, she won't," said Les Holgate. "I'll be blocking the exit on that floor. Sir Edward can only get out if I let him."
I wasn't so sure about trusting this fellow now. He had such a different sensibility to him than your man Tristan. He goes on.
"I'll show up at the same time as Beresford and the constable. You should be in the whorehouse and protest, make a fuss, follow us around. When we find Sir Edward and Morag, you make enough of a fuss to distract the constable, and I'll pull Edward aside and offer him a get-out-of-jail-free card. He can run out the front door and be seen by Simon Beresford and kiss his social-climbing marriage goodbye forever, or I'll get him out safely, and Simon Beresford will never know he's there. But I'll only do that if he signs his name to an oath that he will never fund the Boston Council, no questions asked. Got it?" Absurd, I thought it, dull-witted, absolutely mental. But I nodded, grimacing. So, that was the plan. That is not what happened.
This scheme, this accursed scheme, was easy enough to begin because of how the stars were aligned. I spoke to Morag and explained a little of what we were up to, not about Les Holgate being from the future or such details, just that we needed to blackmail her newest customer and she'd be recompensed for her cooperation. Pim, the owner, has a strict no-blackmailing policy at Tearsheet, but it only applies to blackmail that he knows about, and Morag, being Scottish, is resourceful. To my request, she laughs and says, "Well, Sir Edward and I do have a special little romp planned for tomorrow afternoon. If you want to catch him in the act, this will be the act to catch him in. This will be an act for all the ages to speak of." And she laughs with such abandon that I can't help but be a wee bit curious, suspicious even, of what she's on about. So I ask her, "What are you on about?" I ask her. She sobers right up, although her eyes look like the laughter will still come spilling out of them. "Ach, I might have no morals, but I certainly have manners," she says. "I'll not reveal a gentleman's proclivities." For doesn't she like to show off her schooling with these fancy new words? "But I know he'll be arriving here just as the bell's tolled two, so come at 2:30 and you'll get at least as much as you're seeking." And we'd have to pay her well for that, for it's true her lips are generally as tight as her character is loose. She's the one the fellas ask for when it's especially secret they need to be. She valued her reputation that way, so hard up for money she must have been if she was willing to play our game with us. Now I'll always wonder about that. 'Twas easy enough to find the constable, as he's also the manager of the bear baiting pit, so he's always around Southwark. The constable is a funny enough fella, perhaps on account of his line of work. His assistants, who feed the bears and file down their teeth, are large fellas and fierce, but he's entirely different. Mild and obsequious at once, he is, and doesn't he smile deferentially, even as he regrets to inform you that he'll be taking advantage? I did him a good turn once. The bears don't take to himself or his lads much, yet he's the one keeps them alive and healthy, for isn't a bear a terrible expensive thing to come by? Anyhow, I reasoned with a bear whose wounds he was salving, and the bear stopped trying to smack him. So he owed me a favour for a couple of years now. This turned out to be useful. Les Holgate believed the constable would leap spurs first at the opportunity to intimidate Pim, the Tearsheet brewer. He did not take into account that the constable was less inclined to upbraid brewers than bears, for an upbraided brewer is less likely to pass you a pint. It's a good thing the constable was under a compliment to me, for he only agreed to Les's scheme as a kindness to myself. So in the end, he did agree to put on his constabulary cap and go inspecting the tavern the next afternoon. Les Holgate next wished me to go with him to find this Simon Beresford and induce him to come along with us. But 'twould take more of my time than I'd a wish to give it, so I declined, but, believing I was still abetting a scheme that Tristan was a part of, I did offer to find out Simon Beresford's location, so that Les might go and fetch the fellow his own self. This I did the next day, Les Holgate having slept on a tavern bench overnight and whinging all the next morning. Simon Beresford was on London Bridge, seeking to purchase a new hat. As soon as Les Holgate had set out for the bridge, up to my own closet I went and sought out Tristan by scrying, as I knew he and Rose should be on their way back through the city, headed my way. It seemed to me they were by the Paris Gardens. I sent to Rose as much of this message as I could, which was hard to communicate since she wasn't expecting me to try to reach her. "Your man Les Holgate has arrived and plans to use extortion to accomplish the task at Tearsheet. So I hoped Tristan would have at least a notion that mischief might be afoot.
Then I went back into the tavern and sat back with a mug of Tearsheet Best Bitter, the finest ale you can find outside of Ireland, and waited to see who would return first. It was quiet in there for the time of day, perhaps half a dozen drinkers. I had no personal need to see the scheme succeed, and guessed it would be a lark to watch. But I did feel the slightest bit of unease deep in my gut, and I hoped Tristan would return, as he had a gravity to him that put me at ease, while this Holgate fella made me a bit squeaky-bummed. No surprise it was that Les Holgate returned first, with a confused-looking older fella who had to have been Simon Beresford. He was dressed in the old style, all in elegant black, prudish but not quite Puritan, for then his daughter wouldn't have been one of Elizabeth's ladies, of that I'm confident. His ruffle was pretentious, as if his head sat on a fancy platter that just happened to be balanced right on the top of his neck. Hard to imagine a fellow like that shopping for himself on London Bridge, but it takes all sorts. I heard his voice out in the street, old enough for childish treble. He was asking someone for an explanation. Answers were coming both from Les Holgate and from a third voice I recognised as belonging to the constable. In the tavern I was, as they approached, and wasn't the doorway open to let in the glorious autumn day, so they stood in the door, backlit. Proprietor Pym recognised the constable by his silhouette and cursed under his breath. He went out the door, shooing at them, and made a fuss about letting them in, even as the old fella protested he had no interest in setting foot in such an establishment. I followed Pym out, just to keep an eye on things. So, here we all are, standing on the gravel street, just outside the brewery door, with throngs of people pushing by us going to the theatre or from the bear baiting. We were myself, the constable, Les Holgate, Simon Beresford, and Proprietor Pym. Inside upstairs, of course, were Morag and Sir Edward, carrying on blissfully unawares. The constable shoulders Pym out of the way and strides into the tavern, where right off all the customers make a bit of a fuss, like hens in a coop when the farmer comes in after dark. "Stay outside, sir," says Les Holgate to Simon Beresford. "It's not a proper place for a gentleman like yourself to be seen. Stay here and note who comes out." And then he rushes in after the constable. I follow after him, and so, leaving Master Pym and Simon Beresford outside on the street, with Simon Beresford so dismayed and perplexed to find himself here at all, the trio of the constable, Les Holgate, and myself are rushing through the tavern to the steep steps that lead to the rooms. We're not making noise ourselves, but the tavern regulars are making noise enough to surely alert everyone on the floor above. The wenches in the tavern duck under tables until they realise the constable isn't after them at all. Then they either return to their work or scurry out the hidden door, just to be safe. Now up the steep stairs it is we're going. Constable, Les Holgate, myself. It isn't too dark at all on the landing, not on a harvest season afternoon, with unwanted bright sun outside shining in through a small open window. The upstairs, as perhaps I've described to your grace, has a narrow corridor with rooms off either side. First a couple of rooms big enough for private conferences, and then beyond them four wee curtained-off closets for more intimate congress. It's Morag's closet we're wanting, and that's the first curtain to the right after the meeting rooms. It's the largest of the lot, some 3 strides square, with a mattress on the floor and a curtained window what looks out over the street. We rush past the 2 meeting rooms, both with doors ajar, letting light through the windows, both empty. It's day, and these are the sorts of rooms more used to candlelight. Following Les Holgate's commands, aren't I tugging at the constable's sleeve and complaining of his being here? We come to Morag's curtained doorway. Les Holgate tugs open the curtain. And there's the unglazed window with the afternoon sunlight tempered only slightly by a linen kerchief, so we can see clear as if we were standing in a market square. The constable, Les Holgate, and myself fill the cramped doorway, with me cackling like an angry hen. until I see what is happening inside the wee room, and then my voice does fail me. Your Majesty, I can scarce bring myself to write what we do see there, for it is not Morag there with Sir Edward, but Sir Edward with a third party altogether. From Morag's tone the day before, I confess I had expected a surprise, but I had assumed it might be another wench. It is not. 'Tis a man, and he and Sir Edward are at it with each other, which is a hanging offence here. Morag is not even present. She was but a cover for them to be together. The two men freeze and stare up at the three of us crowded at the doorway so, and quickly part. Les Holgate looks very surprised, but I ken he doesn't understand how dreadful this situation is. Tristan told me that in their age it's only the most religious of zealots, belonging largely to sects of churches that do not even exist in our day, who are much bothered about buggery. In his day, 'tis lawful and unremarkable, even in London. So I'm thinking Les Holgate does not understand that he is looking at two dead men, unless we can bribe the constable with a lot of money straight away. But I'll be honest, that's not the only thing that shocks me. It is the fellow Sir Edward's buggering that shocks me more. For a famous bloke it is. A very famous bloke. There is a commotion back down the corridor, of somebody climbing up the stairs in a hurry, clear enough to hear due to our amazed silence. The constable is goggle-eyed, and finally he says, "I cannot believe what I am seeing. The heralds and the chronicles will never let us hear the end of this. Never." Myself, I can't stop staring at the two men, at the one man in particular, for that man, the famous man, is my lover, who I believed until that moment hadn't a secret from me in all the world. The scuffling on the stairs has turned into footsteps beating their way down the short corridor, and suddenly there's a heaving Tristan Lyons, who grabs Les Holgate and shoves him back down the corridor towards the steps. "You fucking moron!" he says, but then immediately turns his attention back into the room. Pushes the constable out of the way, he does, and sees the two on the ratty mattress. He points to my darling, sitting there, staring at me wide-eyed and naked beside Sir Edward, and asks, "Who is that?" I could barely make myself speak the words. "That," I said, "is Christopher Marlowe." Tristan frowned in confusion.
"Christopher Marlowe is dead. He died in 1593 in a pub brawl. It's almost the only thing I know about him."
Kit and I are staring at each other with a shared look of stupidity I did not think either one of us capable of. "A counterfeit death it was," I say, my chest tight. "Staged for convenience sake. He was a spy, so he was."
"Gracie,"
says Kit in a quiet warning voice. "Sure, it came out after. Everyone knows you're a spy by now, anyhow," I said, and explaining to Tristan. "I had just been sent from Ireland, and so in love with him I fell, and him with me, we would do whatever we asked of each other." Those huge, beautiful brown eyes of his bored deep into mine as I spoke, as I gave away the secret I had kept for years, kept even, I pray you forgive me, from you, Your Majesty. 'Twas the greatest bit of magic I have ever done. He told me they needed to counterfeit a wound that would give him the freedom of seeming to have died, but it must be so thoroughly accomplished that even a physician examining his body would reckon him dead. So they claimed there was a pub brawl, and a spell of protection didn't I put on him, that when he was stabbed he seemed dead but wasn't, although he was close to the shadows for a while. Then I spirited him away and nursed him back to health in secret. And still those eyes, how they looked at me, and how I looked at them. And for these 8 years gone, I went on, in secret I have loved him and he's loved me. I knew he had other dalliances and I was not jealous of him, but the secreting of it, oh Kit, the concealment in my own home. Before Kit could respond or I could say anything else,
Tristan pushed me aside into the room and grabbed the constable by the back of his collar. The constable had been staring at the two men all this time, and while I hadn't been listening to him on account of my own confessions, I realized now he was muttering over and over again how all of it, their impending deaths, as well as this revelation, would shake the city, would shake the nation to its very roots. Tristan lightly slapped the constable's cheek to get his attention.
"The two sodomites must be released unconditionally at once," he said.
To Sir Edward, he said firmly,
"Get your clothes on. While you're at it, open your purse. You will reward the constable handsomely for this act of mercy on his part, and in exchange the constable,"
and here he released the constable's collar, but only to grab his shoulder and turn him squarely to face him,
"the constable will never speak a word of anything that has happened today."
"But that is Kit Marlowe," repeated the constable in awe, gaping still. Then, turning to Tristan, does he offer up this? "He was arrested for heresy just before his death. Did you know that?"
"Atheism," clarified Kit promptly.
"For sure he hates it when people think heresy suggests he was a believer in some sect." "They meant to put him on trial," said the constable. I realized from his obsequious tone that he was collecting his wits now, and expecting Tristan to reward him for this information. All of England was waiting to hear what he said at the trial. There was no pub brawl. He was assassinated to keep from spilling state secrets. Secrets all of London was waiting breathlessly to hear. He can finally spill them. Now he is alive!
"No, he cannot," said Tristan very firmly, as my dad used to speak to me when I was a wee lass throwing a tantrum and he needed me to shut it. "You are about to be given a lot of money to agree for the rest of your life that Marlowe died in 1593.
The constable had recovered from his amazement and was ready to see reason. "I've certainly heard that rumour," says he. "If you'll show me where it's written in gold, I'll happily swear to it."
"I have no gold with me," fretted Sir Edward, "but I do have plate enough back at my lodgings. If I am allowed to dress and somebody shows me the back exit, the constable may follow me."
Listening to him, I felt something beginning to move in my chest. Nothing good, nothing pleasant. Jealousy was a foreign thing to me. I'd no experience of it ever in my life, not that I could recall. And so a moment it took me to realize the name of this horrible feeling. Sir Edward must have sensed my gaze on him. He glanced in my direction, and then casually away again, as if I counted for nothing. Jealousy at once bred with rage inside of me, and made such an inward clamour that I heard the next bit of the conversation as through a hailstorm. Les Holgate, having recovered from being shoved down the corridor, now pushed back in, stepping between me and Sir Edward, and shouldering Sir Edward down onto the mattress. He then stumbled over Sir Edward's flailing legs and was obliged to steady himself at the far wall by the window. He spoke to Tristan.
"Stay on task. This other guy's not important. All that matters is making sure Sir Edward doesn't give his money to the Boston Council. The rest of it, these other people, it's a sideshow. You," he continued to Sir Edward, "your future father-in-law is standing outside. You do as we say, or he's going to know you're a sodomite and you won't get to marry your rich girlfriend."
"And what is it you want of me?"
asked Sir Edward, scrambling to stand. "Swear on the Bible not to give any of your money to the Boston Council."
"Abort!"
said Tristan crossly, as Sir Edward gaped, perplexed. "This is not the time or the way, Les. You've royally fucked this up. For now, for today, we pay off the constable and everyone disappears out the back way. You and I go straight back to the O-deck, but first, you need to go downstairs and tell Beresford there was nobody here. You've botched this."
"I haven't," Holgate said. "You've been totally ineffectual for all the times you've come here. I've come here once, and look. Results!"
He gestured round the wee room.
"Abort," repeated Tristan.
He reached to a peg on the wall and threw the clothes that hung there, shirt and drawers, and a very fine vest it was, at Sir Edward, and spoke to him.
"You, sir, go out the back way with the constable and pay him whatever is required for your own good. You,"
Tristan turned his eye on Kit now. "Will vanish. Disappear. Wherever you've been hiding, go back to hiding there. Sir Edward will keep your secret. Will you not, Sir Edward?"
"Naturally," said a wan Sir Edward, looking ever so much more wan.
"This is the perfect moment to demand submission," said Les Holgate to Tristan.
"Shut up," said Tristan, almost fatigued he sounded, and not bothering to look Holgate full on. "Don't you get this situation? If these two men go outside and are revealed to Simon Beresford, there will be such a scandal."
"Exactly," trumpeted Les Holgate. "That's why this is the perfect moment to make demands of Sir Edward. That's our leverage, their wish to avoid that scandal."
"That scandal cannot happen," said Tristan in a low, quiet growl. "We, you and I, we cannot let it happen. The consequences are too great for us to allow it to happen. It's on us. It's not on him."
Exasperated, Holgate looked.
"You idiot! By saying that in front of him, you've just lost our best bargaining chip, if he even understands what you're talking about."
"Oh, I do, sir," said Sir Edward, as he dressed with shaking hands. He was trying to calm his breathing, and his colour was returning somewhat. "You yourselves do not want this to be revealed, therefore I need not pay you to prevent you from revealing it."
"You do have to pay me, however, my lord," the constable reminded him with a neighbourly chuckle, and waving a finger at him all affably like, "as I have no hesitation to reveal it."
"Neither do I," said Les. "This man, it's Tristan he means, does not speak for me."
"Yes, I do," said Tristan. "I have operational command here."
"He doesn't," Les assured Sir Edward.
"Listen, Ed, I don't want your money. I want your compliance. I'm revealing you to Simon Beresford unless you agree to my demands. He's right below this window." And he called at once, "Simon Beresford! Lord Simon Beresford!"
"Shut up," Tristan commanded of Les Holgate, and immediately stepped right over Kit, snatched Sir Edward by the arm, and hauled him back toward the door, while the poor fool sputtered in amazement that he was being trundled about so. Shutting up was not of interest to Les Holgate, who continued to call out,
"Lord Beresford! There's a fellow up here who looks a heck of a lot like Sir Edward Greylock!"
"Sir Edward Greylock? Up there?"
cried the older man's voice from below, and horrified it was he sounded.
"Sir Edward, pray reveal yourself, sir."
"Of course he won't reveal himself," called Les. "You'd better come up here and see for yourself."
Moving with the swift and sleek efficiency of a wolf, did Tristan now fling an arm around Les Holgate's neck and get Les's throat nestled in the crook of his elbow. With his other hand, he pressed forward on his captive's head, shoving him deeper into the trap. Les's voice dried up into a squawk. His eyelids fluttered, and then he went altogether limp. Tristan let him down onto the mattress like a sack of grain, and devoted a moment to arranging him on his side.
"What have you done?" the constable demanded.
"He's fine. I put him to sleep with a V-choke. Now I'm putting him in the recovery position," Tristan explained. "He'll wake up in a few minutes."
He stood up and turned to face Sir Edward, who by now was sufficiently dressed that he could move about in the streets without drawing overmuch attention to himself.
"Go with the constable out the hidden exit," Tristan commanded. "Give him a lot of money and do not set foot in this building again. Never speak to anyone in this room again except for me when I come to find you at the bell. At that time, you will agree to obey my further instructions to make sure there is no further scandal. Do you understand?"
Sir Edward nodded, looking ill at ease. Tristan stepped back to the window and showed himself at the casement.
"Pray pardon us, my lord," he called down. "There has been a confusion. There is no Sir Edward anyone up here."
"Who are you?"
came the agitated voice from below.
"What in the name of heaven is going on up there?"
"'Tis nothing to do with you, my lord,"
Tristan returned and gestured at me. I understood at once and joined him. This took me past Kit, who reached out a hand toward me, but I slapped it away. I had a score to settle with him, but there'd be time for that later. Is that me Lord Simon Beresford? I asked, using my best London accent. Tristan backed away into the room, leaving me to hold Beresford's attention, like Juliet with Romeo. Not an easy performance, what with the jealousy and rage in my heart and the squabbling behind me, Tristan again commanding Sir Edward and the constable to leave by the back way, the two of them protesting they didn't know where the back way was, Kit scrambling to collect and don his drawers and shirt, offering to show them the back way as soon as he was dressed. He only knew the back way because of all the times he had visited me here and taken such delight in me. And now he was using the knowledge he had of me to save that ponce of a so-called gentleman. Why should he care if Sir Edward be saved or not? 'Twas the shock he was causing upon myself that should be the chief amongst his worries. "And what shall we say when the lights of you are seen loitering around a bawdy ass?" I meanwhile asked down to Beresford with a smile. "'Tisn't a bawdy ass!' Pym shouted up at me in annoyance. "'Tis a respectable establishment, and you know well!' "'Politely waiting your turn, is it?' I grinned at Simon Beresford. "'Don't be shy. Come on up!' The man's face reddened. "'I will not set foot in a place of ill repute.' "'Oh, but, my lord, it's marvellous repute we have,' I informed him cheerily. "'Sure nobody's got better repute than the girls of Tearsheet Brewery. "'It's the talk of London, so it is. "'Just ask the proprietor. That's him beside you.' Pym was scowling up at me. "'What mischief are you up to there, Gracie?' I give him a playful smile. "'A bit naughty I'm being,' I sing out. "'Pardon me, and I'll stop it now!' I turned away from the window. "'Show them the back exit,' mutters Tristan to me. "'Take Marlowe, too.' So now I'm to be saving Kit and the fellow he betrayed me with. As I again brush past Kit, he has finished donning his undergarments, and he reaches his hand for mine again, and this time I grasp it, tight, so tight as if I will never release him. For in truth, all I care about is getting him to safety. Him, yes, but not Sir Edward. For what benefit is there in securing Sir Edward's safety? It keeps him free to continue his dalliance with my love, and it keeps him free to pledge his money where Tristan doesn't wish it. Suddenly, as clear as day, I see the single stroke that will bring succour to both Tristan and myself. As Kit and I approach Sir Edward so that I may lead us all from the building, I bend over a moment, rise up quick, and then quicker still, I make that stroke. Sir Edward puts both of his hands to the close of his velvet vest. A dizzy spell takes him, and doesn't he reach out with one of his hands to steady himself against the doorway? The hand is red, and makes a bloody print on the wall. Tristan takes this in. His face a handsome study in consternation, and his clever mind soon arrives at the only possible explanation. He looks at me, and sure I show him that bloody dagger still in my hand. 'Twas the very weapon he himself had wrested from my dim fella on his first arrival and kicked across the floor to me. I'd snatched it up then to prevent further violence, and hadn't its owner stormed out of the place without reclaiming it. Since then, I'd got in the habit of carrying it. Its sheath was bound to my leg, under my skirts. It had found a home, just now, in Sir Edward's heart. Tristan's amazed to learn it's capable of murder, I am, not knowing a thing of my life back home and the uses your grace has put me to over the years. And so silent he is as we watch Sir Edward settle to the floor, looking a bit like Juliet at the end of that detestable tragedy. He hardly has as much of a beard as Saunder Cook himself. "Well, there," I say to Tristan. "He won't be funding the Boston Council any more, will he?" I see in the corner of my eye that Kit, more concerned than heartbroken, and a good thing too, is ushering the constable out of the room. One of Sir Edward's legs has kicked out near me, so I wipe the dagger's blade on his drawers and slide it into the sheath on my leg, just to keep it handy. Then I get up, stepping well clear of the pool of blood that's been burbling out of Sir Edward, and follow them out. In the shuffle of bodies in the corridor, Kit arranges himself to be beside me. "'I'd sooner slay myself than break your heart, dearest,' he whispers urgent in my ear. "'That man was nothing to me. I was just using him to get some information for Her Majesty. I'll explain myself.' He kissed my cheek, and I confess, Your Grace, it made me wobbly. Never was there a lovelier set of lips to be kissed than my dear Kit's. Pardon me for that distraction. Back to the events now. For a moment, every one of us wants the same thing, to get down to the ground floor. For different reasons, everyone wants it, but still there is a cooperation that wasn't there before, and so in very short order, we are there. The tavern is deserted. People left when all the shouting started, and the blood began sheeting down between the floorboards. A crowd it is now, gathered in the street just outside. Although the front door to the street is open, we can't see out into the glare, so no way to know if Simon Beresford is there. This hardly matters now, for the most important thing now is that Kit Marlowe is recognized by nobody. The secret door for which we are headed is in the back corner behind the bar, meaning we must cross by the front door to reach it. Tristan is in the lead, then the constable clutching at him so he won't be separated from the man in charge, who, in the absence of Sir Edward, is the likeliest one to pay him off. Just behind them comes myself, clutching hands with Kit. Now enters Proprietor Pym through the front door, blinking in the unaccustomed darkness. I turn to greet him, to assure him that, as mad as it might seem to say it, all this chaos is about to be resolved, with the one unfortunate detail that the constable will be learning of one hidden exit. But certain I am that Pym will prefer this to his establishment being revealed as a trysting place for sodomites. As I watch Pym's face, his eyes adjust to the dim, and land upon the half-dressed Kit Marlowe. Kit's not being dead was as much a shock to him as it was to the constable, but he collects himself almost at once, turns to me and says, "Gricey, do you have this in hand?" "I do. We're taking them out the below exit. None will ever see him." I think he will be pleased, but he shakes his head. "Now you know that in Deptford, at the alehouse where Marlowe staged his death." "It weren't an alehouse," I said. "It was a gentlewoman's private home, who rented out rooms." "What about it?" I ask, with a queer worried feeling in my innards. I glance over to Tristan to see how he is faring with the door. The hidden door here hides perfectly in plain sight, for it cannot be detected by the eye, only by touch. Tristan is running his hands over the panelling, trying to find it. And as he does, Pym finishes his thought. "They say business in Deptford quadrupled on account of people going to see where the famous Christopher Marlowe was murdered. So imagine what this will do for us!" And he grabs for Kit, meaning to push him outside into the curious southern crowd forming around the door of the tavern, most of whom will know him by sight. Now, Kit knows his way around a fight, but he's not expecting this. And so before he registers it, Pym's fist, big as a ham hock, has closed around his arm just above the elbow. Kit looks like a boy who's been caught in the middle of some mischief by a fat schoolmaster. Tristan has opened the hidden door. The constable has lost no time in scurrying through it. I can hear him rattling down the narrow case of wooden stairs beyond it. That'll take him down a short tunnel, an expanded kitchen sewer, to call it by its proper name, to a ditch that runs along the side of the brewery. 'Tis what remains of a creek that, I fancy, used to wind through a field to the Thames. Now it is imprisoned between narrow vertical banks that have been built to either side as the city has grown up round it, and it's been half covered over with platforms and bridges. It matters not whether the constable turns left or right along that ditch. Either way, he can slosh for some little distance through the nameless collection of fluids that oozes through it, and choose his moment to clamber back up to the level of the street. So he's sorted. Having seen to that, Tristan is turning back around into the room. He sees how it is with Pym and Kit, and he sees, as I do, that there is no earthly way he can reach them before Pym drags Kit outside. "Pym, you're mad," I say. "Don't make me use this." And I let him see the dagger as I draw it out from beneath my skirt. That stops him, for a moment. "No," Kit says, "don't go to the gallows on my account, Gracie." A pleasant thing to say, but it has the unfortunate effect of bolstering Pym's confidence a bit. Pym gives me a sneer, as if to say, "You wouldn't dare," and drags Kit one step closer to the sunlight. I follow, closing the distance, just in time to be slammed to the floor by one who's just come flying down the stairs. Before I know it, I'm face down on the boards, with a knee in the small of my back, and my arms being twisted the wrong way.
"Got it!"
announces Les Holgate as he pries the dagger out of my fingers. And that's all he has time to say before he's cut down by a meaty punch from Tristan. Les Holgate has awakened from the V-choke, only to be rendered unconscious again by a more kinetic approach. Feeling his knee come off my back, I spring up onto hands and knees and turn to look at the exit, just in time to see Kit, still firmly in Pym's grip, silhouetted in the bright light of the sun. It is now impossible to keep Kit secret. Christopher Marlowe is about to be exposed to the world, and it's as a direct result of magic being used to send someone. If there be 100 men standing outside the tavern, I warrant at least 70 will know his face. And I know what that means, with a profundity Tristan surely lacks. Voices outside the tavern begin to cry out in amazement. "Christopher Marlowe! 'Tis Christopher Marlowe!" As Tristan steps toward them, in a bootless attempt to avoid calamity, I reach out and catch his hand to pivot him around, even as I'm making for the secret exit. He understands and follows. As we stumble down the stairs, we can hear voices in the crowd calling Kit's name. A wee dank tunnel conducts us to the edge of the sewer ditch creek. Tristan's doubled over from the stench, which is a good thing, since there's not enough headroom for him anyway. I lead him toward the Thames. As we scurry along, I note we are being accompanied by an impressive number of rats who seem to have the same idea. Their squeaking is drowned out by the rumble and clamour of the coming Lumma. I knew it was coming, the same way you know when lightning's in the air. I knew that this could happen, Your Grace. Have always known it, in my bones. Sure, every witch knows it as well as fish knows swimming. We see traces of it in the everyday glamour that accompanies our spells. But isn't Lumma, compared to glamour, what the firing of a cannon is compared to a wee candle flame? There are certain changes that must not be made through magic. And while this is true, has always been true, with even the most benign of entertainments, it is far more true and far more dire with sending. For then, you've put one person in a place where they don't know the way of things and are like to make some dreadful change. And it takes an Oirovon plus common sense to guard against. When the worlds cannot bear the weight of one strand suddenly altering that abruptly from the others, it is Lumma. As if you've snapped off a twig upon a hearth broom. It is broken, gone, and cannot be redeemed. So it was that moment. As soon as the public saw Christopher Marlowe alive, this broke the twig. But that image is too soft, for it wasn't a snap, rather the very world seemed to erupt. It's news you'll hear soon that there was a fire at the tear sheet, leading to the collapse of it and the neighbouring buildings too, with many lives lost. 'Tisn't wrong, that, but 'tisn't complete either. 'Tis but a story they are telling to be making sense of what they cannot understand. Fire there was, or something akin to fire. But cold there was too, bitter cold, and bursts of wind that struck like fists, and inhalations that made stout buildings shrink into themselves like a dried leaf crumpled in the hand. But this was more than a mere trick of the air. The very fabric of the world was misbehaving. Think of how 'tis when vomiting, in the moment just before the muck in your stomach rushes up your gorge, when 'tis as though your entire body is clenching itself, trying to turn itself inside out like a stocking. Now, in your mind's eye, see the tear sheet and the neighbouring buildings, the entire neighbourhood, the ground itself and the air above it, the very ether, all doing likewise. Tristan and I were thrown down so hard that we skidded, and drew ourselves up to our feet only when the river came after us as if 'twere alive. Those fortunate enough to be outside the Lumma could save themselves by running fast enough and never looking back. Nearly knocked down we were by several who tried to get clear by leaping off the embankment and into the ditch. Those on the inside, such as my poor Kit and Pym and Les Holgate, were quickly snuffed out with barely time to scream. Or so I tell myself, as I don't like to imagine what worse fates might have befallen them. But didn't those in between, neither to one side nor the other of the Lumma, but caught in the fringes of it, suffer in the most dreadful ways? Impossible monstrosities their bodies became, like two-headed calves you sometimes see stillborn at home, not among your Grace's cattle, but often enough around Loch Swilly or Killybegs. And then, out of that impossibility, decaying like rotten fish in sunlight, flesh coming off so quickly it fizzed and sprayed, and those it sprayed on caught it like leprosy and went down to fates of the same nature. A mercy it was that flames consumed what remained. Milady, never have I believed in the priest's tales of hell, discounting it all as a load of bollocks. But if the Lumma has occurred in other times and places, surely it explains where stories of hell originated. Any soul unversed in magic, who wasn't knowing the true nature of what they witnessed, would try to explain what Tristan and I saw by claiming that the mouth of hell itself had, for a moment, opened upon this mortal coil. But only for a moment. After that, just a fire it was. And who's to say whether 'twas a ravage or a blessing, for it burned to ashes many an abomination spawned of the Lumma. So it seems to me now, upon reflection. But in the moment I could not help thinking of Kit, and Morag, and Pym, and the other wenches of the tear-sheet. No sooner had we got clear of the catastrophe than I wished to return in case any of them might be saved. We were down in that filthy ditch yet, and I began looking about for a handhold I might use to climb up to the street. I saw none, and it's more and more exasperated I became, until all of a sudden there's a hand right in front of my face, reaching down. It's a hand in a white kid glove. Expensive, immaculate. My gaze follows the arm upward until I'm looking into a man's face. He's above me on the pavement, squatting down, offering his hand to pull me up. A yellow beard, waxed and groomed to a sharp point, and the fanciest and most fetching hat with a gorgeous plume on it. It's for the first time now that I'm seeing both of Athanasius Fugger's eyes, for doesn't he have the queerest habit of keeping his hat pulled down low and cocked to one side? I'm struck, in the midst of all the chaos and lamentation of the Lumma, by a peculiarity of the man's face. The pupil of the left eye, the one he prefers to hide behind his hat, is larger than the other. Stuck open, as it were. You might say it were an odd thing for me to attend to in such circumstances, but for some reason it struck me clearly in the moment. I reached up and lay my palm upon his and felt his strong grip. Putting his legs and his back into it, he drew me up out of that ditch and got me safe up to the street. For the first time now I could see the fire and smoke burgeoning from what was left of the tear-sheet. That held my attention while he squatted down again and helped Tristan just as he'd helped me, for which Tristan thanked him in that clipped and wary manner that passes between men who are not sure of each other's intentions. By the time we worked our way back round to the tear sheet's former entrance, there was nothing left of tavern or of brewery. People had scattered, coughing, bleeding, dazed, gibbering like madmen. I saw old Simon Beresford staggering confusedly down the street. Not one other member of our party was to be seen. Les Holgate was no more. No more Morag or Pym. The other wenches of the bawdy house. And worst of all, at least for me, although of no note to another soul, no more Kit Marlowe. And, of course, no more Tearsheet Brewery, the only place in London wherever I was safe.
Diachronicle. Day 390. In which, finally, we seem to learn from experience. Tristan staggered out of the O-deck in a terrible state. He was bruised and his hair disheveled. His eyes bloodshot.